This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. As we approach the midterm elections on November 4th, candidates are hitting the campaign trail, issue ads are dominating the airwaves, and politics have taken over the headlines. In Southwest Wisconsin, there are a number of state and federal races the voters will decide on. Here today to help make sense of the races and the issues are Joe Heim, he's a UW-La Crosse political science professor emeriti, and Tim Dale, he's a UW-La Crosse assistant professor. So historically, what have these midterm elections meant nationally, or what have they meant in Wisconsin? Tim?
Well, midterm elections can sometimes be referenda on previous terms in office. So particularly within the national sphere, we have the midterm literally referring to the middle of a president's term. And so where there are national dynamics, people are sometimes making decisions in midterm elections based on what they're seeing from the president, what they're seeing from parties that are currently in charge. And that has a tendency to trickle down to state and local races as well.
And Joe, obviously, we have a number of hot state races going on.
Yeah, the midterm elections are sometimes nationally viewed as a referendum on the presidency. And history says that the sixth year of an eight-year presidency goes against that party generally. There's only one exception in my lifetime, and that was Bill Clinton, I think, during in 1998 when they were trying to impeach him. The public went to his aid. Other than that, I think you're well aware that President Obama is not His ratings are not particularly high. They're a little higher in Wisconsin, but generally on the negative side, statewide, nationally negative. So the midterm elections in this case, the question is going to be, is this considered a referendum on Obama, or are we going to separate our decision-making from that? State races in Wisconsin, I think, have always historically been a little less related to federal trends, or at least federal referenda, if you want to call it that. So I think we'll have a little less of an impact in Wisconsin on that historical thing. But generally, I've been saying for months, and I bet Tim would agree with this, that the Republicans have a slight advantage going into this election.
And on the federal and state side?
Yeah, particularly federal, but a little bit less so for state.
And Tim? One of the reasons that Republicans enjoy an advantage is just the dynamics of electoral turnout. So the voting trends that we typically watch would be what percentage of a party turn out to vote. And it turns out in Wisconsin, the electorate, the people who actually vote in midterm elections, demographically much more conservative, much more Republican. This is why we get interesting cases where in a midterm election we had Ron Johnson elected to the Senate. In a presidential year, we had Tammy Baldwin elected to the Senate from Wisconsin. People from outside Wisconsin often ask, what is going on where you have those that difference of an opinion? And really, we wouldn't necessarily say that the opinion in Wisconsin changed that much between those two elections, 2010, 2012. But that really is speaking to how the turnout really affects how a midterm result happens. And if this were a presidential year, we'd be probably talking about a Democratic trend because it's a midterm election in Wisconsin. It really is. These typically shape up to be a Republican advantage in Wisconsin. Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about the governor's race. Republican incumbent Governor Scott Walker will be facing Democrat Mary Burke. It's probably worth mentioning, too, there are two other candidates for governor running. Robert Burke is running as a Libertarian, and Dennis Fehr as the People's
Party. He's on the coattails of Mary Burke, I believe.
Sure. But let's talk about this race. I mean, there's a number of issues that we could dive into. But as you're sort of observing it, as we get closer and closer to November 4th, what's sticking out to you as some of the biggest issues for voters this time around? Tim?
Well, I think the number one issue in voters' mind, and it breaks down in a number of different ways, is the economy. And so this race, I think, is going to be at the mercy of the news cycle in a lot of ways. Conversations about job creation, which is a part of the economics debate. Also about the state budget, which is some things that we're hearing about right now. And I think because Walker ran on arguments about the economy, ran on arguments about the state budget, that really is going to characterize the race. But the more that we find out about what the economy is doing, what the job numbers are, and also what the state budget picture looks like, that's going to have an impact. And the more we hear about that going toward the election, it's not just going to be the candidates that are going to be controlling that discussion. It's also going to be the news cycle.
Joe?
For Wisconsin, historically, has always been an issue-oriented state. And I think we're relatively proud of that. People say, I vote on issues, I don't vote for the candidates. This election might be a little different. And the reason is because of the controversies of the 4 years of the Walker administration. You know, the recalls, the Act 10, you know, collective bargaining, all that stuff is still very close to the surface. The polls, as I think you're well aware, show this race virtually tied. I think that, at least as an opinion, I think probably 90% of the public has already made up their mind on this race, and it has almost nothing to do with issues. It has everything to do with whether you like or don't like the governor. He is a very polarizing character, and as a result, people tend to either love him or hate him. The polls show upwards of 90% of the Democrats are going to vote for Mary Burke. Upwards of 90% of the Republicans are going to vote for Scott Walker. Very few are going to cross over, so the independents are probably going to decide the election. But it's really pretty much a referendum. And the polls, despite millions of dollars being spent for Governor Walker, Mary Burke a lot less so, the polls have it virtually tied and almost nothing has changed. The Marquette poll, I think, had undecided is down to about 5 or 6%, if I remember correctly, which means almost everybody's made up their minds in this race. So the issues are not nearly as important as they used to be, and it's kind of a referendum on whether you liked the last 4 years or hated the last 4 years.
And are those polls accurate? I mean, what should voters do with that information, or is it information that's more useful to the campaigns themselves?
There'll be other polls coming out, sure. but everybody's got their opinion about polls. I know from history, just from looking back the last 2 years, that the Marquette Law School poll has been the most accurate, most predict. You're not predicting elections from polls, but that one has been the closest. It's in the margin of error, and they're pretty careful about what they say, basically, about the race being virtually tied. By the way, there's a little, as long as you're talking about polls, I got to stick in one of the most interesting, fascinating elements of the Marquette poll. Had to do with voter registration, registered voters versus likely voters. Historically, everybody knows Republicans show up in greater numbers than Democrats. That's just a fact of life, especially in an off-year election. That's one of the reasons, as Tim said, why Republicans have more of an advantage in off-year elections. This year, the Marquette poll for the last 2 months had Scott Walker slightly ahead amongst registered voters. And in a normal year, if you were tied with registered voters, that would mean that the Republican is ahead 2 or 3 points among likely voters. Keep in mind that only about half the voters are going to show up at the polls, so it makes a difference. This year, for the very first time, the Democrat is ahead amongst likely voters. The Republican is ahead amongst registered voters. Mm-hmm. That is a fascinating statistic that I don't have a good explanation for it. Maybe Tim does, but it tells you that something else is going on out there, a little different than a typical election.
Well, one of the reasons that it's hard to – and we refuse to call polls predictors of elections is that the models that are used can become pretty complex. And pollsters always ask the question, are you planning on voting? And that's another tricky part about polls is that you're not just predicting or describing what the electorate looks like or what the vote is going to be, but you also have to kind of model for what the turnout is going to be. And as Joe's saying, one of the big questions in a midterm election is turnout, and that's actually every election. But when you're talking about a percentage of voters just moving from a 31% turnout down to a 28% turnout or up to a 35-40% turnout, that makes a huge difference. And so if Democrats show up more than they have historically, I think that one of the reasons why we're seeing the close poll is exactly what Joe's talking about. Right now, it looks like Democrats may turn out more than they typically do in a midterm election. But that's going to be a big question mark all the way to Election Day. Really, what is the turnout going to be? And the candidates are much more concerned about turnout, really, than they are about what the polls say one way or the other in terms of who people support.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio and Across. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the midterm elections coming up on November 4th. So is there any way to predict what could potentially sway that small percentage of undecided voters? Is it major issues like the economy? Are they small, maybe social issues? Is it education? Can you predict that at all?
Well, it is difficult to predict, and actually that's probably the secret that all candidates are looking for is how to move those small number of voters who are in that the middle category, the swing voters. I think one of the things that we see as we get closer and closer to election, which is one of the reasons why we see so many negative ads, is that it's much more likely to convince a voter to not vote than it is that you're going to get a voter to switch their vote. So as Joe was talking about, people have kind of made up their minds about who they support. The real question is, are people going to be motivated to vote on election day? And so you really see a dynamic toward in the closing weeks, months of a race, where you're not necessarily going to convince a Burke voter to vote Walker or a Walker voter to vote Burke, but you're going to convince your opponent's voters to stay home on election day, which essentially amounts to a half vote win. And so that really is where voters are deciding, is it worth voting? And I think that's really where these campaigns are going to be spending time, both building the credibility of the candidate that's running, but also where we really see the negative ads, trying to convince the voters that the person you support is not as good as you think.
Joe, I'm wondering, because I know there are going to be so many political issues just dominating the headlines up until Election Day. This week, we're hearing about the $1.2 billion structural deficit, budget shortfall, whatever you want to call it. We also hear about the John Doe investigation. A federal appeals court is taking up that matter in Chicago. Are these issues that will be here today, gone tomorrow? Or are these things that could potentially sway voters and encourage them to get out and vote?
Sometimes individual issues such as this type of news does sway an individual voter here and there. Sometimes it's accumulation of negative stories that make you kind of go one direction or the other. Governor Walker has not had a couple of really good weeks here. You know, he had a couple of different campaign finance issues that came up, $800,000 from the mining group, which indirectly went to campaigns. The owners of Ashley Furniture, I think about a month after they got a very favorable decision on Wedick, contributed $20,000 to his campaign. Those kind of stories, all kind of one by one, they're not big, but collectively they sometimes weigh on people. And you start thinking, well, maybe I don't like what's going on, or maybe things are getting a little too dirty in Wisconsin. So there may not be any one issue that really tips the election, but it might be accumulation of just slightly negative news or slightly positive news. You know, I think that the governor's pledge of 250,000 jobs of 4 years ago has clearly been playing big. And of course, it's, I think, vast majority of people that want to play on that are people, the 250,000 are Democrats who want to say the governor couldn't deliver. The other side of the coin is that he's created around 100,000 jobs, and Republicans say, hey, that's really pretty good. So it's kind of, you kind of grab onto what you want and kind of spin it the way you want it. There's a lot of cherry picking going on with statistics, but that issue does seem to resonate to some degree with the public. If you make a promise, will people hold you accountable for it? You know, will people go to the polls in November and say, well, he said 250, he only covered 100,000, so I'm voting against him. I just have a hard time believing that that's how people would make a decision. But it might be collectively just the economy, or collectively all the stories, positive or negative, that kind of weigh on a voter and make a decision. By the way, to go back to something you mentioned earlier, trying to screen out the less likely voters is not easy. People lie. I'm definitely planning on voting. You'd be amazed the number of those people don't make it to the polls. And there are other people who say, well, I don't think I'm going to vote, and they end up voting. I did see a study a number of years ago that did a panel study and followed people, and it was amazing how many people said they're definitely voting, didn't make it for whatever reason, or other people showed up. So it's a very fluid thing, and pollsters have a hard time figuring out who's actually going to get there. But there's screening questions which give you a pretty good idea.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're previewing the midterm elections coming up on November 4th. My guests are Joe Heim, he's a UW-La Crosse political science professor emeriti, and Tim Dale, he's UW-La Crosse assistant professor. So another race not getting as much attention as the governor's race is the lieutenant governor's race. Is it general, is it likely to go whichever party is elected governor? Of course, we have Republican incumbent Rebecca Clayfish, but she's facing challengers Democrat John Lehman and a Libertarian Joseph Brost and independent write-in Mary Jo Walters. So whoever's elected governor, will that same party likely be elected lieutenant governor?
Absolutely, because they're tied together. They're on the same ballot. Wisconsin's got a very unique system. Many years ago, I can't remember how many, we used to vote for governor and lieutenant governor entirely separate in November. And a number of years ago, for the primary, they allowed that to go on. So you, as a governor's candidate, a gubernatorial candidate, you get paired with somebody you may not necessarily like. However, that person will be in your same party. So when we vote for Scott Walker, you're automatically going to vote for Rebecca Clayfish. That's the way it is now. So it's you don't really have a choice at this point. But I think Tim would agree that people don't vote for lieutenant governors. That's just not. I know.
And even if they were separate, which obviously, as Joe said, they're not, there are races that are considered separately from the governor's race. So we have an attorney general's race, a secretary of state race, that there are issues that are involved. But the lieutenant governor's race, the issues don't get separated. So this is all about the top name on the ticket.
So let's talk about the attorney general's race. There are a couple candidates looking to replace outgoing attorney general J.B. Van Hollen. There's Democrat Susan Happ, who's currently the Jefferson County District Attorney, and Republican Brad Schimmel, the District Attorney in Waukesha County. Are there certain issues that you think are going to really set these two candidates apart from one another, or are people going to be towing the party line?
Well, my understanding is that this is the attorney for the state of Wisconsin, and even though this is actually an administrative job, you're running the Department of Justice. People want to think it's an attorney and who's tough on crime. So apparently a lot of people in their mind want an attorney general who is tough on crime. So what the candidates are now looking at each other's record is to find how weak on crime are they. Can we find any cases? Brad Schimmel's been in office for a long time, and I'm sure there's going to be a few cases that Susan Happ is going to be able to find that make him sound like he's weak on crime. And the same is true for him. So, you know, in terms of doing this on. So this is opposition research. She is a very intriguing candidate. I would tell you most people I know did not think she was going to win the primary. She came out of the primary with a big bounce because it was a surprise. And the Marquette poll had her, I think, almost in double digits ahead of Schimmel. This race, I think people will pay some attention to, but the governor's race is going to suck a lot of the oxygen out of the air. So the issues really are who's tougher on crime, which frankly should not be the primary issue in a race of that sort.
The other thing about this year is that we've had several headlines that involve the attorney general. And so anytime you have litigation involving state law, the attorney general is making statements. And so this also may fall into the category of things that the attorney general kind of just does, responsible for bringing things to court when Wisconsin is sued as a state. But there are going to be discussions about gay marriage involving the attorney general's race. And some of the more controversial the elements of Walker's platform are litigated. And so the attorney general, I think, more than normal, being a position that is in the public eye, may mean that these candidates are having to answer questions that they wouldn't normally answer because the attorney general's office is so visible right now.
I'm curious what will happen with the gay marriage debate, because Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says he will appeal the federal appeals court decision to overturn Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage. So with his time running out, where could that potentially stand? And I guess depending on whoever's elected, will that determine where that appeals case goes?
It's possible, although the candidates probably would rather not answer questions about that. So it throws kind of a wrench in the work. Attorney General's candidates like talking about who's going to be tough on crime. That's a conversation that they're used to having. I think the dynamics of something like the gay marriage decision means that it's going to be unpredictable. And what's happening right before the election may have an effect on the race that we wouldn't even see. And people are going to be turning up to the polls, even as symbolic votes, where that position now becomes a referendum on a policy that the attorney general really has very little control over where it is.
As they like to say, it's in the courts and it will not be decided prior to November. Everything seems to be appealed these days and nothing will be decided prior to November. And this is one of them. I saw in the paper just the other day that, and by the way, the trend clearly seems to be in favor of the courts supporting or opposing discrimination against gay couples. For the first time, there have been 21 decisions, if I remember correctly. 20 of them have gone on the side of in favor of gay marriages, basically. And so the appeal in Wisconsin is probably going to go the same way as those other appeals have gone. It's going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, though. I mean, the court system is structured in such a way that you appeal at different levels, regardless of the outcome of it, and it'll end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, and they'll have to decide this very thorny issue. But for the most part, if you wonder why they're appealing it, because it seems like the courts have pretty much gone in one direction.
And the Secretary of State's race, long-term Democrat incumbent Doug La Follette, is being challenged by Republican Julian Bradley of La Crosse. This could be an interesting race because this comes at a time when certain people, once again, have called for the repeal of the Secretary of State's office. Julian Bradley says he does not want that. He actually wants to see more duties handed to the Secretary of State's office. But is this anything that's going to heat up, or does it just seem that way maybe because we're in La Crosse and Bradley is also in La Crosse?
This is my favorite race.
Is
of
it?
All the races.
Why is that?
Well, it's going to be almost invisible because neither of these candidates are going to spend any money. They don't have the money. But it's a fascinating race in some respects. You know that Doug La Follette's been in office for more than 30 years. He's the last of the La Follettes, and some people question whether he's a real La Follette anyway. We won't get into that, though. But over the years, the legislature, when they aren't happy with what happens in those offices, they take a little bit of power away. He, with Act 10, he held back as long as he could about publishing Act 10, the decision, as a law. He has part, one of his few jobs, basically, is to publish laws. And as a result of that, the legislature took even more power away from him, so he has almost nothing left, that position. But he's running for re-election, and frankly, if you're going to have it, and it's a constitutional office, if you're going to have it, seems to me they ought to give him something to do. Right now, he's the keeper of the state seal, and that's pretty close to being what it is.
So what more can he do? What duties could be returned to that office?
At one time, if you were going to be a corporation in Wisconsin, you would have to file with that office. I did it once for some friends in Milwaukee, and I've never forgotten. I walked into the office, and the receptionist was the Secretary of State. And I've never forgotten that because I thought, what? I felt like walking out of there and, backing out. It was so weird. But he had an office at that time around 100 employees, and you were filing corporate records. At various times, the lobbyist had to register with the Secretary of State. But by and large, over time, a lot of these things have disappeared. But the reason why I brought it up as a fascinating race is just who they are. You have an African-American who is a little overweight from the La Crosse area, Julian Bradley.
Young.
He's dynamic. He's interesting. He's I hate to say it. He laughed at me the other day because I called him a moderate. And in today's world, calling a Republican a moderate is not really good. But he is, in fact, I think, more moderate than he is extreme. And he's just a different type of a Republican. You just can't find African-Americans running as Republicans. Also, you have to know the history. Western Wisconsin has not been the hotbed of candidacies for the state of Wisconsin. If you draw a triangle between Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay, that's where most of our big candidates come from. So that makes it interesting. Can a Western Wisconsin person win? And then he's running against his 30-year incumbent, a La Follette. Fascinating. Are people going to vote for the name? I think it's going to walk and say, "Well, it's La Follette. I remember that name." Or are they going to try something new? And that makes it a fascinating race, frankly.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the midterm elections coming up on November 4th. My guests are Joe Heim. He's UW La Crosse Political Science Professor Emeriti, and Tim Dale, a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor. Let's dive into some of these local races. Maybe just touch on and remind people who some of these candidates are. In the 92nd Assembly District, Democrat incumbent Representative Chris Dano of Trempealeau is being challenged by Republican Isaac Weichs of Elmwood. Are there any major issues in this race or anything that sticks out about these candidates?
The only thing I could say about that is that that district was redistricted like a lot of others, and it's a little more favorable to Democrats. Chris Dano is pretty well known. He's a former police officer from on Alaska. Some people, listeners, may have run into him at some point in the last few years. He also has two master's degrees. I was introducing him at an event a couple days ago, and he's been at four different universities, including he's got a degree from UW-Madison, two master's degrees, one from, I think, an international relations from American University, if I remember correctly, and then a UW-Stevens Point degree. So he's well-educated. We educators like that sort of stuff.
And Wykes has run a number of times before.
Yeah, he is. I'm not sure. I have not seen much about that race around here. But given the district, I would expect that Chris Daniel must be considered the favorite.
And then in the 94th Assembly District, Democrat incumbent Representative Steve Doyle of Onalaska is being challenged by Republican Tracy Happel of Onalaska as well. And, Joe, you were saying before we started recording that you think this could be quite an interesting race.
That race was identified early on by Speaker Robin Voss as one of the top five targeted races in the Assembly for the Republicans. The reason is that district is it leans Republican. I think it voted for Mitt Romney in the last presidential, for example. So it leans that way. It's the suburbs. The district is La Crosse County suburbs, basically, without the city of La Crosse in it. Steve Doyle's well known. He's a moderate. He's kind of has moved to the middle pretty much. And in a district like that, that's probably a good profile for a Democrat because, frankly, it's more of a Republican district. Tracy Happel is a teacher, very pleasant person, by the way. If you meet her, you'd like her. But she's also been on Fox Radio. She opposes Act 10. She's a teacher who opposes Act 10. In other words, the teacher union is not real happy about that. So it makes it for a rather interesting, fascinating race. I think you'll be able to tell how that race is going by the money. Right now, Steve Doyle seems to have a lot more money than she does, but remains to be seen. If it looks like it might be close, you might see a lot of money flowing into that district, and it could be, in fact, a very close race. If this is a real Republican year, that district could go Republican.
And in the 95th district, Jill Billings, a Democrat of La Crosse, she's facing zero challengers. In the 96th Assembly District, Republican incumbent Representative Lee Nearson of Westby is being challenged by Peter Flesch of Soldiers Grove. Both seem to have backgrounds in dairy farming.
They're almost, I've heard somebody say they're mere opposites of each other. I mean, because they're very much alike. Lee Nearson was a former county board chair of Vernon County, and Peter Flesch is the county board chair of Crawford. Crawford's a little more of a Democratic county, but that district leans Democratic. At one time, that was a Republican district. Now, in recent decades, the last decade or so, has become more Democratic. So Lee Nearson is running a slightly uphill battle in a district which you would expect go in the other direction. He voted against Act 10, against his own party in favor, and he said basically he's doing it because the teacher unions and his district wanted him to. And so it tells you he can't get pushed around, frankly. It's kind of interesting. He's a very low-key sort of a guy, but he has his values and basically gets it across. Peter Flesch is one of the strongest candidates against him, however, in recent years. And as I said, he's a mere opposite of him. And he could, in a more of a Democratic year, in a district which leans Democrat, Peter Flesch could be the surprise winner.
And let's talk about just a couple Senate races going on in this area. We'll first start with the 31st Senate district race. Democrat incumbent Kathleen Vinehout of Alma is up against Republican Mel Pittman of Plum City. Feinhout obviously has been in office for many years.
I'm going to toss this one to Tim.
What's that? Yeah.
Tim, help me out. I don't know much about this one.
Well, the interesting thing about this race, Vinehout was kind of on a short list of people who were considering running for governor.
Sure.
So in terms of statewide kind of celebrity and notoriety, Vinehout is up there. And I think one of the interesting things about all of these races is kind of how the dynamics of the races at the top of the ticket are going to affect them. So we have districts that have been redistricted that have become safer. But I think that turnout question is going to have something to do with where these races go.
But you think redistricting could potentially play a role in the
outcomes? Although the redistricting that's happened has all been in favor of incumbents. So that in any analysis, I think the incumbency advantage has been made stronger by redistricting, whether a Republican or a Democrat. And the redistricting has favored Republicans because they're in the majority right now. So the incumbency advantage is for the majority. But I think overall, when we're asking questions about if Walker's going to get more people to the polls or Burke, it may have an impact on some of these races.
Joe?
I was going to just comment that district has often gone Republican. It flip-flops back and forth over the years. It's a little more Democratic than it used to be. It is not, however, listed as one of the 10 big races in Wisconsin. Democrats seem to think they're going to hold on to it. Republicans don't seem to have focused a lot of attention on it. I did notice in a primary, however, that the two Republican challengers ended up with more money than Kathleen Vinaut had. So it'll be interesting to watch that to see how the money flows. And if the money flows in a district, maybe that's an indication that the polls are becoming more favorable to the Republicans. On balance, I think you have to think Kathleen Vinaut is probably the favorite, however.
And a Senate district race that a lot of people across the state are watching in our area is the 17th district. This is Dale Schultz's seat, Republican Dale Schultz, who is stepping down. This was an interesting primary because Pat Bomhack, Democrat Pat Bomhack, who will now be facing Republican Howard Markline, he and his challenger, Ernie Whitwer, there were too many, the votes were too close to call. They had a recount, and Ernie Whitwer earlier last week decided he was going to step out of the race. And so how do you think this is going to end up shaping up?
You want to, okay.
Joe?
That race, I thought, had some interesting sidebars to it. In the primary, you had Ernie Whitwer, who was the grassroots candidate from that district. Not a particularly attractive candidate, according to Democrats. And because of that, this district leans Democratic, and the perception was that Democrats could pick this up. This was perceived at one time as the number one Democratic target in the state. If they're going to pick up any seats, this is one they have to pick up.
In order to gain control,
they need, I think it's 1815 right now, mm-hmm. if I remember right. They need that if they have any chance at all. They've already lost one seat in the Racine area. Where they redistricted it so the Republican is going to win. So that's one loss already. Howard Markline is a state representative from that district, only one of the three districts down, and he's got huge, I think, $300,000 to $400,000 in money. Mm-hmm. And clearly the Republicans do not want to let go of that seat. Dale Schultz is staying out of the race, which kind of tells you something that he's not real happy with the candidates, or at least the Republican candidate. He's always been a moderate Republican who's often voted against his own crowd. And he's paid a price for that at various times. But Pat Bomhack is the choice of the leadership, Democratic leadership in Madison. The institutional party people wanted him. They thought he'd be a better candidate than Ernie Whitwer. And he obviously won the recount, if you want to call it that. I got to give Ernie Whitwer credit for staying out of that, or at least not requiring. He could have taken to the courts. You know, there were some votes that disappeared.
Sure, in Greene County.
Even with those votes, it turns out that Pat Bomhack wins with like seven votes or something. It's some ridiculously small margin where clearly an unhappy candidate could have gone to court with the whole thing. So he's chosen not to. But every day that they drag this out is one day less that they can beat Howard Markline.
One thing that it always seemed like Dale Schultz said he sort of towed that moderate line is because that's how his constituents were. Is there any sense that Markline or Bomhack could be moderate, whether moderate Republican or moderate Democrat, or do you see that district maybe becoming a little more partisan?
Well, I think the key to winning in a district like that is moderation, and so I think the typical line is that candidates tend to moderate in the general election. So we'll hear from those candidates about the ways in which they see themselves vis-a-vis their party's policies. But I think it's reasonable to predict that would be a moderate senator, regardless of who wins that race.
Do we want to talk a bit about the Republicans maintaining control of the legislature? I know, Joe, you just talked about what it takes for them to maintain control of the Senate.
That's one of the interesting questions of this race, not that race alone, but just in general. The Assembly is 60-39 Republican versus Democrat. And I don't know anybody who thinks the Democrats have a chance at taking over that body. Their only chance, and by the way, they could take over the governorship, of course, but failing that, then we're down to the state Senate. If the Democrats lose all three of those, we're going to have a continuation of the Walker administration shifting the direction of the state of Wisconsin, the likes of which we haven't seen probably in 100 years. I mean, his first 4 years were, clearly, in my mind, clearly a policy shift of a major dimension, and that will continue. There's some of the Democrats who are very fearful talk about certain issues such as right-to-work laws. So they're fearful that if all three bodies, basically, you know, three branches, if you want to call it that, the two branches, move in one direction, that there's going to be a continuation of a conservative trend in the state of Wisconsin. If, in fact, the Senate moves to the Democrats, they could block the agenda, basically, of the governor. So at that point, and that's why this is such a high-stakes election for Democrats, because otherwise they're, frankly, going to be shut out for the next 2 years.
Tim, did you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, and the Democrats are definitely fighting an uphill battle. And so it's very unlikely they will control state legislature completely. We might end up with something that we see at the national level where you have a split legislature, Republican on one chamber and Democrats in the other. But I think part of what makes this so interesting is that the state legislative races may have an impact on how effective Burke would be as governor, even if Burke should win. So a policy initiation happens in the legislature, and there's some decisions that governors can make that have an impact regardless of what's going on in the legislature. But Burke will be tied to whatever the composition of the legislature is. And at least right now, it looks like one of the chambers is going to be Republican. So as Joe said, it will be a difference if the Senate changes hands. But watching the legislature really will be as important as watching the governor's race.
Tim Dale is a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Joe Heim is a UW La Crosse Political Science Professor Emeriti. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll continue our preview of the November midterm elections. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. The midterm elections are less than 2 months away. In southwest Wisconsin, there are a number of candidates vying for seats in the legislature. And across the state, incumbents are trying to hold on to their spots in Congress. Here today to talk about the November 4th elections are Joe Heim, he's UW La Crosse retired political science professor, and Tim Dale, he's UW La Crosse assistant professor of political science. So let's talk about the 3rd congressional district race here in southwest and now western Wisconsin. Democrat incumbent Ron Kind is facing Republican Tony Kurtz, but also Ken Van Doren, who ran as a Republican in the primary. He's now running as a write-in, as an independent. What are the major issues in this race? Obviously, there's a lot of things going on in regards to foreign policy. There's health care. What do you see as really getting voters to the polls? Joe?
Well, this is one of those races where you have a long-term incumbent versus a new challenger. So it's a fresh new face, basically. Ron Kind has been in office for a long time. He had a tough race against Senator Dan Kopanky, I think it was 4 years ago, a very Republican year. Since that time, if I remember correctly, his district has been redistricted more Democratic. Am I getting that right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it's the district has now been, I'll say, gerrymandered, because from a fairly decent-looking district, it's now a Y. We now have, it's just a huge district, frankly. We are now over in Stevens Point, part of the district. And he's one of the issues in the race for Tony Kurtz has been that Ron Kind has been in office too long. It's time for change. I think he's using an ad, has a statistic about amount of money that Ron Kind is getting from outside his district, which is a very large number, special interest money, that kind of stuff. So those are issues. Ron Kind is more of a moderate Democrat, occasionally votes for the Republicans. Tony Kurtz is, he's not a Tea Party Republican. He's more of a, I would say, conservative, typical conservative Republican running on defense. He's a 20-year Army veteran, if I remember correctly. He's a farmer, Prairie du Chien area, and a very attractive candidate in many ways. He's kind of learning the ropes. He's a little bit new to politics, basically, but he looks pretty good. But this district leans Democratic, and Congressman Kind is perceived by almost anybody, I think, as the favorite.
And Tim, Joe mentioned the amount of outside money coming into this race, which is something that we hear about in a lot of Wisconsin races. Can you talk about why it is that we're seeing a lot of money pour into third congressional races, the governor's race?
Yeah, well, congressional races, there are a lot of national kind of political implications, obviously, who controls the Congress. I think a really interesting question is about kind of why it is that people outside of Wisconsin are interested in the outcome of races that happen inside Wisconsin. And it typically turns a lot of voters off when they hear about how much money is coming in. Actually, many of the negative ads we're seeing for all sorts of candidates is one candidate accusing the other of getting outside money. And that's the big negative thing, although they gladly cash
They're
the checks that come in
money.
From the outside. And I think it's a really good question to ask because I think it points to how important these races are, not just for politics within the state of Wisconsin, but also for the big ideas and the contrast between the candidates. So it is definitely the case that Walker's reelection is a reelection not only about Walker's governorship, but also about the ideas that Walker has brought to state government. And so when you have people donating money to Walker's campaign or donating money to Burke's campaign from outside of Wisconsin, these are people who have an interest in the outcome of that race, not necessarily because they care about what happens in Wisconsin, but what they care about what happens with the ideas. And I think that the big principal differences between the candidates is why we see so much money coming in from groups that are interested in those big principled questions.
And Joe, you said it seems like it could the third congressional district could safely stay in Democratic hands. Is that race, I mean, does it ever really get much national attention? Is it something that Democrats across the country really focus on in order to maintain their control? In order to maybe regain control of the House?
Well, the parties at the national level have two goals, basically. One is to protect their incumbents, you know, and protect what they've got and defend them. Second is try to pick up enough seats to take over. There is an outside chance that, at least in the House of Representatives, the Democrats could win. Is it likely? No, especially because this is more of a Republican year, at least historically. I think they need to pick up around 16 or 17 seats, if I remember correctly. I may have my numbers right on that. But you have to know that of the 435 districts in the United States, close to 400 of them are no longer competitive. They're designed and drawn to advantage the incumbents, basically. So you have relatively fewer chances of picking up a competitive race, and that's why the money all focuses on those races. I don't know how this works. There's some kind of a national network out there that funnels money to those races that look like they're competitive. And the money word goes out, send money to District 27 in West Dallas or Green Bay or whatever. You know, you pick out because that's a competitive race. And all of a sudden, money will flow into that from outside places. And you wonder who those people are, where they're coming from, and why do they care? It's because of national control of, say, the Congress, basically. So outside money does make a big difference. Now, comment about Scott Walker, by the way. In addition to the policy implications of what he did over the last 4 years and why he's considered a national star, he is considered one of the four or five possible presidential contenders. For a variety of reasons, there's a lot of interest in his race because he could be conceived as one of the contenders nationally.
And so, Tim, do you want to add on to that?
Well, I think one of the things to add is that as much as people negatively perceive a kind of national attention, until voters start punishing candidates for receiving outside money, we really won't see that change very much.
And you don't feel like voters are doing that at this point in time?
That's one of the interesting things about this election is that it's been something that ads have been saying, but it doesn't really get a lot of traction. So voters are really concerned about the issues. And so the politicians being able to be bought and sold, it almost seems like voters have kind of accepted that people who are in politics are willing to cash checks from anybody. And I think it really comes to those policy issues. But really, voters have control over this. And if they start to vote against candidates who accept money, it will change. But until that happens, it looks like this will be a part of politics for a long time.
Is there anything you've noticed during this campaign season that maybe differs from what happened 10 years ago or so?
One of the things I think, and we've been talking about this for a while, is that Things have become kind of hyper-politicized in Wisconsin. So kind of even related to some of those state races that we wouldn't necessarily think are kind of political races, the Secretary of State really being kind of a bookkeeper, Attorney General who's just responsible for heading the Justice Department. Because of all the debate surrounding Act 10, because of the recall, it's very difficult for anyone to kind of get out of the politics of the wider context. We see this at the national level too. So Barack Obama's embattled, Congress is embattled, you know, historically low approval ratings. And so on the one hand, people are trying to run away from their parties, but on the other hand, they need the money and protection of their parties. And so I think that's one thing that's remarkable is just how political the races are and also how polarized. So as Joe mentioned earlier in our conversation, a lot of people have made up their minds because they've made up their minds about the big issues that these races link to. And so I think that's one of the things that's remarkable about politics in Wisconsin right now.
Joe?
Well, it's one of the unfortunate things that seems to the direction of the country that we've nationalized more and more of our races. There used to be the old line about all politics is local. It seems less so than it used to be. There's fairly strong evidence that satisfaction with the presidential's performance carries down further than it used to, especially through Congress and the Senate, but even into the state races as well. That's a change which I'm not sure I like, but it has certainly happened to some degree.
One thing I was wondering about, too, is how many issues and actions are almost put on hold because of the election season. I was reading in the Washington Post that President Obama said he's going to wait on any sort of executive decision when it comes to immigration reform until after the November elections. Is this something that presidents and lawmakers have always done, or is this something that has changed as we've entered this more polarized election cycle?
Okay, well, it definitely is something that we've always seen. So one of the things that we talk about in political science is the electoral connection. So people who are in office will make decisions based on what they think will guarantee them the best chance of winning an election. And so they choose policies they think will help them win an election. They don't choose policies that they think won't help them win an election. I think with Obama's decision and other decisions like it, it's an interesting question because usually candidates can run on victories. So if you fight for a policy, obviously policies that succeed, you can run on them. Policies that fail, you kind of hammer away at why those policies failed. But the thing is, we have really complicated issues kind of at the heart of these disputes. So even though people have opinions about immigration, how to solve the immigration problem is incredibly complex. And this, we actually see this with infighting within the parties themselves, particularly the Republicans. Southern states, border states have completely different politics around immigration than states in the North. An issue like immigration is a strategic decision in part because it is so complicated and it's very difficult to tell how that would impact races. And so it's sometimes easier to not deal with an issue, particularly if in the case of what's going on in Congress and the presidency right now, there probably wouldn't be a successful immigration bill passed by the time the election happens. And so if it can only help and not hurt reelection chances of people in your party, and by the way, that goes for both sides of the aisle right now in Washington when it comes to immigration, chances are that people are going to stay away from it.
Joe, we'll see if Congress and the president actually addresses immigration after the election. But do you see other federal issues that Congress will need to really tackle after these elections?
Well, they have to pass a budget. That would help. They have not passed a single appropriation bill so far this year. They're going to come back and pass a continuing resolution to get it past the elections, and then in December, depending on what happens and who controls the U.S. Senate, they will either push it off into the next year or they will pass some kind of a compromise bill of some sort. The immigration issue is interesting and reflective of a lot of interesting things, actually. It's very complex. The Senate, if I remember correctly, passed a bipartisan bill on immigration reform, which I thought was pretty good, frankly. The House, however, refused to take it up because a substantial number of their members do not want to deal with immigration. They're very much opposed to it, and it reflects, as Tim said, the split of that party on immigration, depending on where you are and who you represent. The president, unfortunately, said several months ago that he would make a decision on his own. If Congress won't act, he will, and he would do this by the end of the summer. That was a mistake because, therefore, everybody expected it to happen. If he went ahead with executive actions on immigration, a number of senators who are very, very tight races felt that this would disadvantage them and it would energize the opponent's base, basically. So my understanding is they appealed to the White House to put it off. He did. He's getting battered by both sides, basically, for doing that. But it's a political decision because he doesn't want it to affect the outcome of the election, especially the U.S. Senate races. But he will address it in December, so he promised.
Tim, I'm wondering if you have any brief final thoughts as we approach the elections on November 4th.
Well, I think one of the things kind of as a political scientist that we'll be watching is how this election is remarkable. So one of the things we've typically seen is that voting trends in Wisconsin have favored Republicans in midterm elections. The governor's race is very competitive. We're going to be watching turnout very closely. A lot of people are paying attention to politics. Big question, is that going to translate into turnout for the election? And so there are a lot of interesting things going on at the state and national level, and so it'll be an interesting couple of months.
And Joe, any quick final thoughts?
Well, I think a lot of this has to do with control. Which party controls Congress, which party controls Wisconsin, those are the big things. And in even a broader sense is size of government. Underlying all of this is one party thinks government should shrink and be smaller. The other side thinks government should be big and take care of a lot of things. A very basic question, and that's what elections are here to decide.
Joe Heim is UW-La Crosse Political Science Professor Emeriti, and Tim Dale is UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Shrub, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show or want to find other recent editions of Newsmakers, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.